So he starts to tell himself this story that Benjamin Franklin must be good. He must be someone worth loaning this thing to, sort of using cognitive dissonance to your advantage. And basically, it's been verified by psychological studies since then. It turns out that when you do someone a favor, you actually feel indebted to them, you would think that doing someone else a favor would make them indebted to you. In fact, asking something small of them in some ways can build a better connection because now they're like invested in you. And I would try to ask questions or think about things that they would like and that they would, you know, feel like they got value out of too. And that's something that it's like a subtle psychological shift that people miss for some reason.
Yeah, it's Ben Franklin's such a fascinating character. I really enjoyed reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Ben Franklin, which leads me to ask you, I mean, which historical figures do you find most instructional, helpful? I mean, who are the figures outside of the big three Stoics that you sort of repeatedly look to as your own benchmarks or to learn from?
Yeah, there's obviously a bunch. You know, in the book, I talked a lot about Ulysses S. Grant, who I thought was really interesting and a sort of a totally underrated, underappreciated historical figure. I talk about John D. Rockefeller, who I thought, and again, all these people have problems, and so I don't want it to descend into like hero worship of any kind. It's you look at the people and you look at the good that they bring to the table, and you focus on that, not on the negative stuff. But I talk about Ulysses S. Grant, William Tecumseh Sherman, who is another Civil War general I'm really interested in. I think Richard Feynman is a fascinating character who asks all sorts of interesting questions. And he had this what seemed to be this sort of joy and curiosity to him that I appreciate a lot. Cyrus the Great is another really fascinating character was, again, one of the most powerful people in the world, but seemed to be universally regarded as a good person and not in like a propagandist way. So those are some of my favorites. I don't think it's a stretch to use fiction either. Like I find it weird that people don't look at fictional characters as either good examples or bad examples.
So who are some of your fictional favorites?
One of my favorite books is this book, What Makes Sammy Run by Bud Schulberg. It's about this Hollywood screenwriter. It's like a young Jewish kid who's like a total hustler who's like endlessly ambitious, and it's sort of it's very Gatsby-esque the book, but the point is this guy's like hustling and running all the time, but he never stops to question why. The moral conclusion of the book is that he gets everything he wanted, and it's like the worst thing that you could ever wish on someone,
right?
And so that's something like I try to think about a lot too. It's about finding the people that you relate to in fiction or nonfiction, and then seeing what you like about them, like you like about yourself in them, and using that to bring out more of it, and also seeing what you don't like about yourself in them and using it as a cautionary tale.
That's a really good point. Yeah. I have a few books on my bookshelf facing out. And I just moved into a new place, so I had the chance to organize my books however I wanted, which was a delightful and extremely time consuming monkish process for me, being as OCD as I am. But one of them is Zorba the Greek. So
right.
Zorba, it's just such a great cautionary tale for me, because you have like the intellectual slash want to be intellectual who's very introverted and spends too much time tail chasing in his own head versus Zorba, who's so engaged in the moment, et cetera. You know, very maybe Epicurean in some ways. And yeah, that's really interesting. Also have Dune. I thought, a number of the characters in Dune were very, very interesting. Stranger in a Strange Land as well. So let's look at where you are now, because I've been continually impressed by at what a young age you have accomplished certain things, whether that's responding to huge responsibilities at American Apparel with marketing, responding to those criticisms publicly, dealing with all sorts of difficulties, not difficulties, but challenges that we all have, but professionally on a pretty public scale. You're 26 now, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So this is your third book, which just to put it in a chronology, I mean, the 4-Hour Work Week, I guess it was published, were written when I was 29, so you're still 3 years ahead of me with three books. what do you attribute your ability to get shit done? I'm just very curious as to if it's like, well, you blend my two parents and here you are. Like, that's how my parents are. This is how I am. How much is nature versus nurture? I mean, what has contributed to your ability to multitask and also to get this much stuff done at this age? I'm curious to hear your opinion.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, so obviously I had two smart parents. They inculcated in me, you know, a love of reading and questions and sort of told me I could, you know, do whatever I wanted with my life, like, which was all very helpful. You know, and I talk about those type of people in the book, the people who came from sort of nothing or worse than nothing, and that's why they were successful. That's not me. And then I had these amazing mentors, which were very helpful. And I also have a big head start on people. I mean, I dropped out of college when I was 19 years old. So I've been doing this, like most people my age started at 21 or 22.
Right.
So they're sort of just getting started. But, you know, that being said, I think I actually – and the reason I wrote this book is because – Stoicism was, I can trace all, so much of the good stuff in my life to specific passages in Stoicism that helped me or made me think about, you know, certain things. Like this idea of the obstacle being the way, that there's no such thing as bad things happening to you, that everything is an opportunity to like prove yourself or to do something good is something that's been, you know, enormously beneficial to me. There's also there's a quote in book 5 of Meditations that I used to have printed up on my wall. And it's this conversation where Marcus is sort of actually having it with himself, like it's dialogue. But he's like, so you're waking up in the morning and you're covered in the blankets and you know you should get up, but you say to yourself, like, but it's so warm here, like I want to stay here. And he says, like, but look, you're a human being. Your job is to get up and work. And it's like, what do you mean you've worked enough? Like, would an animal say that? Like, would an animal ever say that they'd done enough work? And then he says, like, people who love what they do wear themselves down doing it. They forget to eat and sleep. They just work because it's not work. It's who they are. And I think for me, getting stuff done has been a function of being able to start having that conversation with myself when I was, you know, 19 years old, rather than like, you know, partying late at night and then waking up hungover every day. Like, I didn't do that. And I really think it's the cumulative process of waking up every day and going to work and like really working and not caring about the rewards or the success, but working because I love what I'm working on. Mm-hmm. That compounded interest is one of the most powerful forces on earth, right? And you can apply that to your own work. And every day, if you wake up and you work on something, you get a little bit closer and it grows. And I think that's been, you write one book, it's easier to write another book, you know, right. And then you write two books, it makes it easier to write a third book. And I've never been a fan of doing just, I think you're like this too. I don't get how people do just one thing. Like, you're really good at investing, but could you just do that? I don't think that would fulfill you as a person.
Yeah, I couldn't do that alone.
And I think it's weird, but I found that the more things that you're doing, the better. It's like, okay, if you do one thing, you can be really good at it. If you do two things, you feel really busy. But if you do like 3 to 5 things, you're not that busy and they all help each other and make you better at them. So for me, like writing and marketing and research and all the things that I was doing at the same time made me better at all of them, and it sped the whole process of learning up really fast.
When you are most productive, how often are you running? Because I know that that is another part of your life, or at least historically has been.
Yeah, so I run almost every day. I run every day, but then I also, you know, from some of your stuff and other people, I know it's not the best thing physically for you. So I usually do CrossFit like 2 days a week, and then I try to swim 1 day a week, and so I run the other days.
Right. Yeah. I found, I think long walks are also very underrated.
Totally.
Which, yeah, I mean, we could go through the long list of people who've said that historically.
Yeah. Well, but I definitely don't think of walking that way. And I actually try to not think of running that way, almost not as exercise. Like, I think it has a better impact on your brain than it does on your body.
I agree.
Definitely walking. It's like, I've written huge chunks of my books because I went for a walk and then I had a breakthrough that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I think it might be Anand Taleb, who also doesn't trust people who won't go for a walk when they speak with him. I could be just making that up, but I'm pretty sure I'm not.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, sounds about right. And then he'll sprint to imagine. What did he say? When he has to motivate himself to sprint, he will think of like running after the head of the Federal Reserve and smashing them with a baton on the back of their head or something. He's a hilarious guy. Let me back up to a separate question. You're a prolific reader. You have a sort of recommended reading list that's quite popular, an email list that people subscribe to.
Yeah.
And I've really been impressed by your synopses of the books that you read. But for someone who is not an avid semi-full-time researcher like yourself,
right,
what are the top, say, you know, two or three books that you either discovered or delved into while researching The Obstacle Is the Way? I mean, if you had to pick your top two to three, you're like, all right, if you want to maximally gain in whatever way, I'll leave it open to you.
Sure.
Read these two or three books. Like, if these are the only two or three books you read this year, you'll be better off for having
Well, I'm looking at the bibliography right now, and some that jumped out at me that were total favorites. Ron Chernow's biography of John D. Rockefeller, which is Titan, the Life of John D. Rockefeller, was like a total game changer to me. It was an amazing biography. I like Sarah Bakewell's book, How to Live. It's like a series of essays about Montaigne, who invented the essay.
Yeah.
He's really fascinating.
Again?
Sarah Bakewell. I like, let's see. Oh, I read this book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. He was this totally fascinating but relatively unknown historical figure. He started a fruit company buying the about to expire bananas that would be imported in like late 1800s America, and he would sell them by train car. He ends up buying United Fruit. He starts a small fruit company that it grows to be so big that it buys United Fruit Company, which is the biggest fruit company in the world. So that's why he's known as the fish that ate the whale. He's this sort of fascinating Jewish businessman. I read a really good biography of Edison by Matthew Josephson called Edison, A Biography. And if there was any others, I'm trying to think. Yeah, those were some. Oh, and I read a really good biography of Ulysses S. Grant called Ulysses S. Grant, Triumph Over Adversity.
Got it.
That I loved a lot.
Just writing these down myself because I need another 20 extra books on my Kindle that I haven't read. I'm just kidding.
Right. I want to give you some more 700-page biographies because I know you need more of those.
Very cool. The Fish That Ate the Whale. That is a fantastic moniker.
Yeah, that one's really short, and you'll really like that guy. He was crazy, and he was like the I can't even describe it. You should just read the book; it's amazing. The writer that wrote it, Rich Cohen, wrote another amazing book called Tough Jews, which was about like JEWS,
right?
About Jewish gangsters, like basically like the people that you see on Boardwalk Empire.
Yep,
he's an amazing writer who you'd really like.
So I view books oftentimes as tools, right?
Yep.
Part of the toolkit for making these better decisions, obviously, and enjoying life at the same time. I do love reading. Are there any other tools that you use or rituals that you have had consistently and found useful? So I'm curious, maybe we can start with the second part of that. What does the first 60 to 120 minutes of your day look like? When do you wake up? What is your morning routine look like? And then maybe we can talk about your daily routine if there is one.
So I try to wake up somewhat early, like 7:30 to 8. I'm not always successful at it. So I try to wake up early, and I try not to check my email in the morning if I can, but I'm not usually successful at that either. But I try to sit down and I write for like the first hour to 2 hours in the morning. I find that there's less going on. There's less people bothering you. There's a great writer. He has a site called Farnham Street. His name's Shane Parrish.
What is the name of the site?
Farnham Street, F-A-R-N-A-M.
Okay.
And he wrote an article recently where he's like, look, the number one productivity secret is just wake up early. because there's less going on. You're more productive at the beginning of the day. So I try to get my writing done in the morning, like whatever I'm working on. I try to like bust out an article. If I'm working on a book, I try to tackle a chapter. I try to write in the morning for an hour or two. And then I sort of get to work from then when everyone else is kind of waking up and getting going.
Okay. And then what does your day look like from that point forward?
Yeah, I usually go out to breakfast. I try to eat at the same restaurant every day rather than, you know, deciding what I want to have for breakfast.
What do you eat?
Usually 3 eggs and 2 sides of bacon. So I get a ton of protein. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have like guacamole or something with it if I want to liven it up a little.
Get some non-animal matter.
Yeah, exactly. although I got chickens at my house, so I don't always go out anymore. Sometimes I have fresh eggs at the house.
And you're in Austin.
Yeah, I live in Austin. And then I go to work. Like I have a one index card that I write usually the night before my list of things to do that day. And I try to keep that list like pretty small, like 5 to 7 things usually. And I cross all those things off. They could be small things like email so-and-so, or it could be like, you know, write chapter 3. You know, it could be big thing or a little thing. I cross those lists off, those things off. And then the rest of the day is just responding to stuff that's happening, whether that's emails or phone calls that I've scheduled or meetings that I have to do. I try to avoid as many meetings or phone calls as humanly possible.
How do you go about doing that? Are you diplomatic, or what's your approach to deflecting meeting requests or coffee dates and so on and so forth?
Yeah. Paul Graham actually has a great essay about this called Maker versus Manager.
Oh, it's such a good essay. Yeah, that's a great piece.
But it's really hard. Like, you're someone who fits in this category when you're both a maker and a manager. Like most makers are just not good at doing the other thing, so they don't do it. It's hard when you actually have stuff you have to manage. But sometimes I'll just lie. I'll say like, hey, I'm traveling, I can't do the phone. Or like, hey, I really prefer email. Like if we can hammer this out over email, I'd be much better. And I know that sometimes email takes longer than doing a phone call because you have to go back and forth. Yep. But the point is it doesn't interrupt what you're doing, and it does it like on my schedule. I just try to be upfront about it. I just say like, hey, like, look, I really hate jumping on the phone. Can we just do this over email? And most people are understanding. And the people that aren't, I either don't care or I understand that they're more important than me and they get to dictate the terms, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the point about, number one, I have the exact same habit with index card. That is the finite surface area I find. Much like Parkinson's law helps to refine how you prioritize. But the point you made that I think is really important to underscore, among others, is that just because email might take slightly longer does not mean phone is better. Similarly, you might choose a slightly longer driving route because it's easier to remember and it's more scenic.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
As opposed to being like, yeah, I'm going to sit through like horrible traffic with people honking where I have to really pay attention the whole time and can't daydream, but it's 15 minutes shorter route. And there's a really important question, or an important question that I've learned to ask myself, and I'm sure I didn't create this, but I don't remember the attribution if I didn't. And that is, it's not whether you can afford the time or not, it's whether you can afford the distraction.
Yep.
And you know, that's why it's like, yeah, it might only take you 5 minutes to call someone, but you and I both know if you're writing something or if you're a coder, that could mean you start the clock from zero and it's going to take you 45 minutes to get back into the flow of what you were doing.
Yeah.
You know, I admire your writing because it's a reflection of clear thinking. And I'm wondering what you see as the most common mistakes that writers make. What are some of the most common mistakes where you write for quite a few outlets online, and you're really prolific. You write a lot more than I do, and you know, I'm envious in a way of your output. What are the biggest mistakes that you see writers making, not professionally necessarily,
sure,
but just like stylistically, editorially? What are some of the bigger mistakes, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's weird. I write a lot, but I think I write a lot out of humility. Like, I'm trying to get better, and I think that the only way you do it is by making commitments to write a lot, publishing, and sort of getting feedback. So, you know, 3 books in 3 or 4 years is a lot, but plenty of people do more. The articles are designed to make the books better. That's the way that I think about it.
Right.
But I think a couple mistakes that writers make. One, they don't have anything to say. They think that writing is good. Like they think that writing is the skill that is scarce and good. Like putting sentences and words together is good. It's like, look, I would read a biography written by someone with like a seventh grade education if what they were talking about was fascinating. You know, like have you ever seen that thing where it's like they take a bunch of sentences and they take all the vowels out or they move the words around?
Right, and you can still read it? Yep.
Yeah, it's not the technical skill that's rare. It's having something interesting and compelling to say. So I think that's the big thing is people don't have that much to say and they focus all their time on technical writing rather than like saying something that's never been said before. This maybe ties into that, but I see a lot of writers who start writing before they've figured out exactly what they plan to say and who they're saying it for. Like they're trying to find the point while they're going. And so I use note cards to organize my research, and like I very rarely write anything that isn't fully outlined and sketched out, especially books. So the writing is the easy part. Figuring out what you have to say and doing the research and bringing something new to the table, that's what's special and rare. So I focus my energy on finding the stories or the thing that I'm bringing to the table that no one else but me could bring. Mm-hmm. And I think far too many writers skip that. And that's why we get these crappy bulleted lists or, on the other hand, like an 8,000 word article that like could have been 20% of the length. And so I think those are mistakes that writers make a lot. I think also just not being honest. I think a lot of people are either pretending and like puffing themselves up with their writing,
right,
or they're hiding something. Like James Altucher, who we both know.
I was just going to mention James. He's so good at doing the opposite.
Yeah. He has this rule where he writes the thing that he doesn't want anyone to know about himself. Like whatever he's afraid to say, that's what he wants to write an article about. And look, sometimes that ends disastrously and he gets in trouble. But most of the time, it creates this vulnerable, authentic voice that people relate to because no one else is saying these things. And your job as a writer is to touch something inside of the audience. And you can't do that if you're lying to yourself.
No, definitely. Huh. I find writing process just endlessly fascinating.
Totally. Because no one does it the same way.
Yeah, everyone's different. That's one thing I realized really early on. Like there are best practices for marketing best-selling books. Mm-hmm. There are very, very few consensus about the best way to write a best reading book, if that makes sense. I mean, that's part of the reason why I fell in love with Daily Rituals, which profiles, 170 or so world-famous creatives, whether it's writers, composers, scientists, et cetera, and how their daily schedules are laid out because they're so different. It's really fascinating to me. Do you watch documentaries? If so, what are your favorite documentaries that come to mind?
I love documentaries, but I don't watch that much like TV. So yeah, but some favorites. I like Fog of War, I think is amazing. Mm-hmm. That Phil Spector documentary from a couple years ago is pretty crazy. I think it's called The Wall of Sound, but I forget what it's called exactly. Mm-hmm. There's the guy who did Fog of War has a new one out about Donald Rumsfeld that I want to see called The Unknown Known. But I love Ken Burns. I've watched like pretty much every Ken Burns documentary you could ever see, including all 10 hours about the Civil War and all 10 hours about the National Park System. So I think I love any art where the person doing it is clearly like the master of their craft.
Right.
And to me, Ken Burns is like the best person who ever lived at documentaries. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how anyone could beat him. And so it's like I'll watch 10 hours about national parks because it's that good, even if you don't care.
Right.
So I think I love his stuff.
Yeah, that's funny you mention that. That's how I feel about John McPhee as a nonfiction writer.
Totally.
I mean, he's for those people who don't know who he is, he's at least a one-time, maybe a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And I was fortunate enough to have him in seminar for nonfiction writing called the class was called The Literature of Fact when I was an undergrad for 1 year, which was amazing. It was really hilarious, too, to get back a 3-page writing assignment and to have more red ink from him on the page than black ink You really feel like a dumbass when you realize how sloppy your thinking is when you get something like that back. But you know, he's written books on everything from an entire book on oranges, an entire book on one tennis match, an entire book on hand-carved wooden canoes, a book on Plymouth Rock. I mean, it's just the breadth is so amazing. But if it's written by him, I just don't care. If it was a book on chopsticks, I'd be like, absolutely, I'll read a 200-page, 300-page book on chopsticks written by John McPhee.
Right. I love – he has that one Control of Nature that's really fascinating. That's just about like – it's like about the Mississippi River, some volcano in Iceland, and the hills of Los Angeles. And you're like, this should not be fascinating, but like I'm hanging on every word because you're so good.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, chances are he's been writing for so long. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker for decades and decades and decades. I think he's got to be in his 70s or 80s even – now, but I remember researching The 4-Hour Chef, and I was like, I bet there's something that McPhee has written on cooking and food, and I bet it's going to be one of the best pieces in the English language. And lo and behold, there is this piece from sometime in the maybe 80s called Brigade de Cuisine, written about this tiny restaurant in New York and just this maniac executive chef. And it was it's like, all right, there we go. Like, yep, the best I've ever read about cooking or food, and of course it's John McPhee. Yeah.
So, totally.
What are some of your goals for this year? I'm very curious to know if do you believe in resolutions that are long-term resolutions? Is it tiny habits day by day? I mean, what are some of your goals, whether for this year or shorter term? I mean, how do you, or longer term for that matter?
I don't know. It's not that I don't believe in goals. It's actually been a weird, and this sounds, I'm sure, like a humble brag, but it's a genuine problem. So, or a first world problem. Like I wanted to write books. Like that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to be a writer. That was my
that's
thing.
What, but, that's what you wanted to be even growing up. Is that what you thought you were
going to
be?
Right. Yeah. And so I accomplished it very early, and now it's like, okay, now what? And, but there's, I don't have like, well, now I want to be the biggest author in the world. Like one of the benefits and then also consequences, I guess, of Stoicism is that it's very humbling, and it sort of helps filter out very selfish or materialistic goals, I would say. So like I'm not like, oh, I want to have millions of dollars, or I want to have hundreds of millions of dollars. Like it's like I'm quite comfortable. I would like to continue to be comfortable, but like that ambition is somewhat sated. I have more book ideas, so I'm in the process of thinking about and potentially selling another book. Mm-hmm. But I'd like it to take longer, and I'd like to challenge myself in ways that way. I think I'm engaged. I'll probably get married this year, so that's like something. I think like in a lot of ways.
I would hope you would have some plans for getting married, or if there was just like, no, I figured out the engaged part, but I'm not sure on the marriage part. Right.
Right. Well, no, it's like a
hold option.
Yeah, right. Now I've got some time. I bought myself some time.
The option agreement with your girlfriend.
Right. I locked it down, and now I'm just going to wait. No, it's. I think I would like to focus on less sort of external goals and maybe more internal goals. I don't think there's anyone out there that's like, I'm exactly as like low stress as I want. I'm exactly as sort of like kind or forgiving as I want. I'm exactly as, you know, like happy. Like I'd like to focus on sort of internal personal stuff in terms of integrating and adjusting all the things that have come into my life over the last few years into the kind of like everyday norm that I would like. So it's not a specific thing, and that might hold me back in some ways, but I think it's less about like sort of external publicly validated success and more about just like, all right, is this the person that I want to be? Well, kind of, but here are three or four things I would fix. Well, like, let's focus on those.
So two related questions that are follow-ups. The first is, if you want to be a writer and you write a lot, you mentioned one of the problems with a lot of writers is they just don't have anything to say. How does one go about having something interesting or meaningful to say? And how do you do that? Let's begin with that, and then I have a question about working on internal goals.
Sure. So the best writing advice I ever got, and I think it came from Tucker, but I don't remember. But someone asked him like, "How do you become a writer?" And he said, "Writers live interesting lives." And that's how you find something to say. Yes, this is true for fiction or nonfiction. Go do interesting things, experience the world, and develop some sort of perspective or knowledge or wisdom that you can pass along through your writing. So the 4-hour work week came from your experiences running a company and then deciding to travel. And, you know, my first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, came out of my experiences in marketing and doing a specific kind of marketing and having a sort of existential crisis that came along with that. And this book came out of my studies and experiences, you know, like researching and reading and just living my life in a high pressure, high stakes environment. And I know that seems weird, but just like the best marketing decision you can make for a product is to have a really good product that people want, the best way to have writing that people want is to live a life and have experienced the world in a way that allows you to communicate something to people that they've never heard before. And I think it's actually especially true in fiction because you're like, at least in nonfiction, academics can write good nonfiction books based on their research. But nonfiction, you have to be able to communicate all these intangibles to the reader.
You mean fiction?
In fiction. You have to communicate all these intangibles about life and about relationships and about how the world works. And if you haven't gone out and lived it and experienced it, you're at a distinct disadvantage when it comes to communicating those things because it's like you're like the 40-year-old virgin who's trying to like talk about sex.
Right, like a bag of sand. They felt like a bag of sand.
Right. You can fake it until you say something that's so obviously wrong that just everyone in that instance knows that you have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, good point. And I mean, that's been really my maybe way of compensating for what I perceive as a very imperfect writing style. I don't think that I am the best writer out there. I view myself as a teacher first and foremost. So my cheat has been to follow in the footsteps of someone like George Plimpton, who is a really fascinating character, who's the editor of the Paris Review and really popularized what he called participatory journalism, where he would go become a professional football player for a season. He would go try to join the circus for a season. He would go try to box 3 rounds with Archie Moore, for instance,
right,
and then write about the experience. And you do not need, just to underscore what you said, you do not need to be a college-educated wordsmith to have compelling writing if you have a good story to tell. It's just that simple. And you know, I remember talking with Tucker about this, and you know, a lot of it really just comes down to, I think, writing in a natural voice, basically writing as you are, which takes practice, but having a good story to tell. What does financial security mean to you? How do you define that for you, for yourself personally?
Are we talking like specific numbers, or are we just talking about like what is financial security sort of generally?
Both, to the extent that you're comfortable. I mean, it's
sure.
You know, it's whatever you're comfortable talking about. It's just that I think this is such a huge piece of so many decisions that people make, bad and good. So
right.
I'd be curious to know how you have sort of resolved this for yourself to the extent that you have.
Well, I guess there's a couple ways to be rich, right? One is have a lot of money so you can buy a lot of stuff. Or the second, or like if you sort of express being rich as being able to buy whatever it is that you want, right? Whenever you want it, there's two ways to do that. One is to have tons of money, or two is to not want as much stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think if you meet somewhere in the middle where you keep your tastes under control, like for instance, like I don't fly first class. I could afford it, but I don't fly first class. And I have before, but the point is like I just don't want to get in a habit of flying first class because now it means like if I want to travel somewhere, it's going to cost me X amount.
Right.
And I'm going to have to do things that I maybe don't want to do to be able to get that money.
Right.
And I'm going to make decisions for the rest of my life around that assumption. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to have to do that. So it's like, how do you limit what you, there's that quote from Paul Graham about keeping your identity small. If you can keep your tastes at a level at which a reasonable salary or financial situation covers it, then you don't need to go out and do certain things for money that other people do. Like, to me, financial success is I have a house that I live in that's nice, that I can keep my stuff in, that I have my books in, but I don't have like six spare bedrooms that I needed to fill up with furniture because I wanted to send a message to people that I have a really nice house, you know?
Right.
And I don't live in New York City because I don't need to live in New York City, which means that I spend a lot less just to have the same thing, you know? Right. And it's like, can I go to a nice steakhouse and buy whatever I want and not care what the check is? To me, that's being financially secure and about sort of what I need to not care about money. And then I think the other, it's not just being financially smart on your spending, but like, you know, do you actually understand investing and managing your money in a smart way? So it's not like there's all these people, I'm sure you deal with investors or startup founders or whatever who have like credit card debt. And it's like, why are you trying to like invest in startups when you could just make 13% more a year by not carrying a credit card balance? You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So I think just sort of basic financial responsibility and management helps you make what you're doing go further. Mm-hmm. So like that's been beneficial to me. But there, you know, there's the study about any amount over $70,000 a year does not correlate with any increased amount of happiness. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely true, having made a lot more than $70,000 a year and a lot less. So for me, it's like, you know, somewhere above that is happy and comfortable, and the rest should just be saved and managed, like the Stoics say, for a much worse time because you never know what's going to happen. Don't spend the money you make because you might not have it and you might want it some other time.
Sage advice. Yeah, it's hard to predict, nay, impossible to predict when the next black swan will hit.
Totally.
And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, not to misdirect the conversation, but the fact that much like human action and climate change, technology, in a sense, has led to superstorms, let's say storms of the century, perhaps happening as often as every 3 to 20 years now, which was a recent piece that came out of MIT, the instantaneous dissemination of hysteria through mm-hmm. social media, I think, greatly increases the probability of higher frequency black swans because everything is so interconnected and humans are, for better or for worse, certainly in large numbers, pretty irrational masses. And I just feel like, if anything, you know, these sort of once a century, twice a century stock market crashes and so on are probably going to happen more often. But that's pure speculation on my part.
No, I think it makes sense. And it's like, I quote this in the book. There's a line from Warren Buffett about being greedy when others are fearful and being fearful when others are greedy. And we definitely live in a time where people are very greedy. And I think it's really important, too, that you don't at all correlate being financially successful with worth as a person. So the fact that, you know, I know someone who's worth X million and I know someone who's worth, you know, less than nothing doesn't say anything about their value to me as people and how I should respect or treat them. And if you can keep that in mind, you won't feel like the fact that so-and-so is making $80,000 a month on info products. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like I know this, but it doesn't make me care about making info products. Like I want to write my books because they pay me enough to be happy, and that's what matters.
So speaking of sort of the valuing people and different people, this and the feel free to answer this however you like. For your circle of friends, number one, you know, these days, how do you curate them, right? If it's not on net worth, which is, yeah, I agree, it shouldn't be.
Right.
How do you curate your friends that you end up being the average of, right, as a group? Mm-hmm. And over time, let's just say over the last 5 years, 10 years, what has become more important and less more important or less important?
It's weird. I think a big part of it is keeping like toxic, unhealthy people out of your life, like people who have drama and problems and pathological issues. I think those are important people, not only not to be friends with, but to extricate yourself from as much as possible. So that's something I've thought a lot about. I like people who make me laugh. I think that's important. I think people who I don't have to try to impress. Like, it was weird. One of my friends from high school was in town, like, over the weekend. And it was like, I don't think we talked about, like, work at all, because he was doing his thing and I'm doing my thing. And what matters is that we have, like, a shared history or a thing that we relate over. So to me, I don't know about you, where when your work is also tied up in your personal relationships, I really value people who I can exist in the present moment with. So it's like, I can do something with them. I can have a conversation with them. The fact that, you know, they do this and I do this is irrelevant. And the fact that they live here and I live here is irrelevant. I look for people that, like, I may have gotten this for you, is like the idea of someone you can sit and have a nice long dinner with. To me, that's a friend, mm-hmm. not someone I have to meet at a bar or, you know, any other context.
Makes perfect sense. Let's do just a couple of rapid fire questions.
Okay.
And one to think on, just as we're doing this, is I'd like to hear a story of what Aisha Tyler calls self-inflicted wounds. So just like a ridiculous story, a debacle, a fiasco of some type that was self-created. Sometimes that's involving alcohol for people. That doesn't have to be true for you, since I don't think I'm not sure if I've ever seen you drink alcohol. But okay, first one. What would be your theme song or your like ring entrance music if you had to choose one?
Let me pull up iTunes. Let me see if I have anything. I don't know. I like Iron Maiden. If I had to pick like an awesome entrance song, probably something from Iron Maiden.
Okay. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
This is ironic. I don't love my voice that much.
Mm. I feel the same way. Not about your voice, but about mine.
Do you think there's anyone who's not like a narcissist that enjoys the sound of their own recorded voice?
I haven't yet met them, but I'm sure they exist.
I heard it's actually because you hear your voice differently. Apparently, it's like when you're just talking, the voice that you hear is different than like how it's recorded, and it's just the difference that makes you feel bad about yourself.
You know, that's an enabling belief, so I'll take it.
Sure.
thanks for that. When you think of the word successful, who is the first person who comes to mind and why?
No one comes to mind. Well, I talk about John D. Rockefeller in the book, so there's an example, one of the world's richest men.
Got it. All right. If you could study a new subject with any expert in the world, who would it be and what would you study?
Like a new subject or just a subject different than the one that I study?
By new, I mean new to you. So yeah, different from what you've already immersed yourself in.
I think I'd love to do like archaeology or something like that. I don't know a specific person, but some sort of ancient site or dig would be fascinating to me.
And you spent time in Rome looking at like the burial site of Seneca and so on. Is that right?
Yeah. I spent some time in Rome when I was finishing up the book, and I just went to like the sites and stuff that are in the book for sure. And I was in Dublin. I was in Dublin like 2 weeks ago. You'll love this. They took us into this crypt, like a burial site that preserves the bodies, and they had these mummies there from like the 12th century, and they let us touch them.
Wow.
I was like, we are a long ways from America. Like, are you kidding? We touched the hand of this guy who died in the Crusades.
Wow. Yeah. That's that would definitely be cordoned off in the U.S.
I think so, yeah.
Do not chew on the mummy. If you could offer your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be? Let's place that. Yeah. Younger self, freshman in college.
Relax.
Relax. Why?
Every young person that I think you probably get this too. Every young person that I talk to, I feel, especially like an ambitious one that seems to want to talk to me, I feel like they're on the verge of like a nervous breakdown or an explosion of some kind. because everything is so serious to you when you're that age. And I think maybe it's our parents that did it to us or whatever, but I feel they're like, you know, if I got to do this or like I'm going to die. Like it's like everything feels like an issue of life or death, you know?
Right.
And it's so the opposite of that. It's like in all of history, you are in the safest, most nerf bumpered area that has ever existed. You could do anything short of murder and you're probably going to be fine. You know what I mean? Like, you have unlimited time. Like, just relax, take it easy. You're not going to care about this in a little bit of time. And that's probably what I would tell myself.
So just to take a quick sidebar from the rapid fire, you dropped out of college. I feel like there is a survivorship bias in media that leads to a romanticizing of dropping out of college. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on who you would advise to drop out of college, who you would advise to stay in college, because you ended up very uniquely, in my experience, extremely well-read and extremely well-rounded. Mm-hmm. And when people drop out of college, oftentimes they say, well, it's because it's not going to prepare me for job X or Y or Z.
Right.
In my opinion, at least in a liberal arts college, still is that the goal is not to prepare you for a single career. The goal is to make you a well-rounded, developed human being. So I'd just be curious to know what your caveats are, who you would recommend consider dropping out versus not.
Yeah, so it's funny. I was looking at there's a Wikipedia page that's like a list of college dropout billionaires. And it's funny. It's like, it's the definition of the survivor bias, because there's like, let's say there's 500 billionaires in the world and like 20 of them were college dropouts. That means even among billionaires, most of them went to college, right? Yeah. So, but you only care about the ones who dropped out of college. So I think, like, for me, dropping out of college was a pretty simple calculation. It was, would I stay in college and graduate and hope to have this same opportunity that I'm being offered right now? And the answer was,
and that was the Tucker opportunity.
It was Tucker, Robert Greene, and then working for Aaron Ray, who we both know at the Collective in Hollywood. So it was three things that either one of them individually I would have killed for as a post-grad job. And so I said, you know, I'm going to do this now and see how it goes. What I think the problem with dropping out of college that everyone misses in the discussion is that dropping out of college is not a thing. You take a leave of absence from college, meaning you can go back at essentially any time. So again, when I'm saying like relax to the 19-year-old version of me or whatever, it's like, dude, it's not as black and white as you're making it out to be. Like, take risks. You're in a cohort where you can absorb risk, and then understand that you're not going to starve to death if this goes poorly. Like, for me, it was like, I'm going to take advantage of this. And a year from now, if it's not working out, I'm going to go back to college, because college is the best default option if you don't know what you want to do, because it keeps you on the level with everyone else. And it gives you some sort of certification that sets you apart from like people who didn't go to college. So that's how I think about college. And I'll say this, the people who should not drop out of college are the people who are doing poorly in college, because college is exactly like life. It's a system that you have to figure out how to get the most out of and do your best at. And if you're failing out of college, you are probably going to fail at life, because if you don't address the root reasons why you're doing bad at college, you know? Right.
Learn to game the system while you still have headgear on before.
Exactly.
Cool. All right. I appreciate that, because it's something that I get asked about a lot. So it's nice to have your input. All right.
And one other note on that. It's like I always hear from people, it's like, oh, I want to leave college so I can travel, or I want to go to college so I can like start a company or get a mentorship. And it's like, these are not things that you have to leave the womb to do. Like, you can do them in college. And so you should leave college if you have an opportunity to do something that can only be done outside of college, and if you will kick yourself if you let that opportunity pass and it doesn't come back your way again when you're graduating.
Yeah, and that's a great point, actually. I think that it would be very fascinating to look at billionaire dropouts and see how many of them had started the company that was going to later make them a billionaire, and proven to themselves that it had very real legs and a time-sensitive window before they dropped out. Because I think the percentage is probably very high.
Right. That's what Zuckerberg did.
Yeah. Yeah. And many others. Awesome. So we'll take just a little bit more time. I'm going to do a couple of rapid fire so people get to know you and not just your thoughts on stoicism. All right. So you walk into a bar. What do you order from the bartender?
If it's in Austin, I order Topo Chico, which is like a Mexican sparkling water. If it's not Austin, I'll probably just get soda water with lemon and lime or cider.
Do you ever drink?
Just cider. It's the only thing that I like.
Got it. So it's not a moral decision. It's a taste decision.
It's a little of both, but yeah.
Okay. What makes Mexican sparkling water different from normal sparkling water? I have to ask.
I just like it better than Pellegrino, but I will say that I fully embrace the ridiculousness of eating or of drinking imported water from Mexico.
Especially Mexico. All right.
Right.
Who is your favorite person to follow on Twitter? And you can give two or three if you'd like.
I like fake Jeff Jarvis, who I think is hilarious. I like Felix Salmon a lot.
Who is Felix?
Felix Salmon, he's a blogger for Reuters.
Got it.
And then I don't know who else. Oh, Media Redefined by Jason Hirschhorn is a pretty good Twitter feed to follow. Oh, and Maria Popova of Brain Pickings.
Yeah, that's a great site. Speaking of sites, what sites do you visit on a regular basis?
I don't visit a ton of sites. I use my RSS reader. So I use Feedly, where I've subscribed to a bunch of feeds. Felix is one of my favorite. I like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who blogs for The Atlantic. I like Mark Cuban's blog a lot. I think Reddit, if you subscribe to the right subreddits, is a really good way to get like sort of highly curated news.
What subreddits do you subscribe to?
Stoicism is a good one.
Besides Not Suitable for Work.
Yeah, sure. Stoicism is a good one. Philosophy is a decent one. History porn is a pretty good one, which is just like old photos from history.
Yeah.
Ask Historians is my favorite. So smart people ask unusual questions about history that only like academics or historians answer. Mm-hmm. Today I Learned is a great one, where it's just like a fact that, you know, people was unexpected. Mm-hmm. I like First World Problems. I think that's a funny one. And then there's one about Civil War. There's one about writing. And then I like Reddit Books as well.
Yeah. Reddit Books is big.
Yeah.
What is the first face that comes to mind when you think punchable?
Punchable. I don't know. That's a good question, though.
We can come back to that. It could be a fictional character, too, if you'd like.
Sure.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs, of course.
Why?
Cats are just an animal that lives in your house.
Got it. And okay, so elaborate on dogs, because you said something to me that I was hoping to have you elaborate on, was that dogs, you think dogs make you a better person. I was curious how you think they make you a better person.
Dogs exist totally in the moment. Dogs are the definition, I think, of sort of unconditional affection. And I think it's really interesting to have an animal that evolved to live and depend on humans the way that dogs did. Like dogs, they think were domesticated because they, like wolves would come and eat scraps from the like the campfire, and basically we slowly selected the most sort of docile, friendly, mischievous of the animals, and that's where dogs come from. So I think dogs are great because they're this thing that depends on you and needs you, but at the same time you can never truly disappoint. So it's this great sort of metaphor for life. I think it's just great practice. And plus they're super cute and they do like hilarious things. I have two pet goats also. I don't know if I told you this, but I
no.
I have two goats, which are pretty funny. They're like really dumb dogs.
Do you milk the goats, or do you just have them for comedic effect?
Just mostly for comedic effect. Like I don't like people have asked that, but I just don't have that much need for goat's milk. So it's not. You have to breed them to get, because they're Nigerian dwarf goats. So you have to breed them to get milk, which I'm not really interested in doing.
Sounds really low yield. It's kind of like milking cats.
Right. Like, what do I need? I'm just this guy who's always trying to pawn goat milk on people. Like, let me give you some.
Right, right.
Like the friend that has
delicious
an orange tree.
Nigerian dwarf goat milk sounds.
Yeah.
That could become a thing in San Francisco. You could export.
Probably.
Yeah. What book are you most likely to give out as a gift?
Probably Meditations. God knows how many copies that I've gone through. And then the second one would be The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Yeah, it's a great book. what movie can you not resisting if it's on, assuming that you had a TV in an imaginary world?
Well, of course, I have a TV. I'm not a weirdo. I love TV. Gladiator.
It's appropriate.
I like Spinal Tap's one of my favorite movies.
Have you seen Shaun of the Dead?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. You have to see Shaun of the Dead. S-H-A-U-N. It might become one of your favorite movies. It is.
All right.
It is splendid. I wrote about half of the 4-hour work week with that on repeat on a TV.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. I have to have total silence.
Well, but here's where I am a weirdo, among many other ways, is I would play the movie because I tend to write late at night, and it's easy to feel isolated and crazy and like Nicholson in The Shining.
Right.
If you're always by yourself, at least for me, so particularly without any dogs or anything around or people. So I would put the movies on with characters that I liked, and I would mute the TV and then listen to music while that is just human forms in motion in the background. Oddly enough. Yeah, just a habit that I have. Who was your first celebrity crush, if you've had one?
Celebrity crush.
Or current celebrity crush. Any celebrity crush.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Nicolas Cage?
Yeah, I'm a big Nicolas Cage fan.
Do you cook?
Like, I cook bacon.
Okay, I can't end on that question and answer. If you could choose three people, let's just say living people, to be your sort of circle of advisors or elders to help you with major decisions, who would they be?
It's weird. Like, so I've gotten an iteration of that question where it's like, oh, you've worked with all these people. Who else would you want to work with that you haven't? It's weird. I feel like very fortunate that I haven't. Like, Robert Greene is one of the sort of most respected strategists about power and life and history. And like, he's someone that I call when I have questions about stuff. I think you're one of those people that I call, and you're a world renowned writer and marketing expert and an investor. And then the third person is my girlfriend, now fiance, who I think is really good at sort of reading people. And more importantly, she knows me and like what my weaknesses or issues are, which I think is really important. It's not just about like, objectively what the best thing to do in a situation is.
Absolutely.
It's like, what can you do given your constraints or tendencies? Like, oh, you should totally take this job. Well, if you're someone who's pretty flaky, that's not great advice. Like it's oftentimes it's what you can do with your taking you as a person for granted, who's going to behave how you've always behaved. If you can have someone who understands you well enough to give really good advice, I think that's super important.
So I think that is a great note to wrap up on. How can people better or best get to know Ryan Holiday? Where should they find you online? What should they read of yours? Give us some suggestions so that people can dig a little deeper, which I hope they do.
Yeah. So my website is ryanholiday.net. I'm Ryan Holiday on Twitter. I suggest people start with the books too, because I put myself into the books. So The Obstacle is the Way. Trust Me, I'm Lying is my first book. I did a book called Growth Hacker Marketing, which started as a Kindle book, and now it's going to be a paperback. And then I write, almost weekly for Thought Catalog. And then I'm the editor at large of the New York Observer, where I have a series of columns about media and life and other things there.
Fantastic. Well, Ryan, thanks for the time. Always nice to chat. And this gives me an excuse to sort of ask you 20 questions in a way that isn't totally socially weird over a meal. So
this was amazing.
Yeah, this was super fun. I will, I'm sure, talk to you soon. So thanks. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Ryan, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Acknowledgements. It was Dr. Drew Pinsky, of all people, who introduced me to Stoicism. I was in college and I was invited to a small private summit of college journalists that Dr. Drew, then the host of Loveline, was hosting. After it ended, he was standing in the corner and I cautiously made my way over to nervously ask if he had any book recommendations. He said he'd been studying a philosopher named Epictetus and that I should check it out. I went back to my hotel room and ordered the book on Amazon along with another, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, translated by Gregory Hayes, arrived first. My life has not been the same since. I want to thank Samantha, my girlfriend, who I love more than anything. We'd only been dating a few weeks, but I knew she was special when she went out and bought this book, Meditations, which I had been raving about. She deserves extra credit, if only for enduring my many private and admittedly unstoic moments over the years. Thank you for coming on the many walks with me where I thought out loud. I want to thank my dog, Hanno, not that she is reading this, because she is a constant reminder of living in the present and of pure and honest joy. The book you've just heard would not have been possible without Niels Parker, whose editing and long talk shaped it. It would not exist without Stephen Hanselman, my agent, who pushed for it, and my editor, Nikki Papadopoulos, who believed in it and fought for what was a radical departure from my first book. Thanks to Adrian Zakim for giving me my shot and providing a home for me as a writer at Portfolio. I need to thank my master teacher and mentor, Robert Green, who not only subsidized my reading of many of the books I used as sources, but taught me the art of crafting a message and a book. His notes on my drafts were invaluable. Thanks to Aaron Ray and Tucker Max, who showed me that a philosophic life and a life of action were not incompatible. Tucker, you're the one who encouraged me to read and the one who told me to follow up Epictetus with Marcus Aurelius. I just found some endearing old emails where I asked you a million questions after I did. Thanks especially to Aaron, who pulled me out of school and forced me to live in the real world. Thanks to Tim Ferriss for encouraging me to write about Stoicism for his site back in 2009, and for our long talk in Amsterdam, which provided great additions to this book. I owe Jimmy Soney and Rob Goodman for their excellent notes and book on Cato, Sean Coyne for his suggestion of a three-part structure. Thanks to Garland Robinette, Amy Holliday, Brent Underwood, Michael Tunney for their thoughts and feedback. Thanks to R Stoicism on Reddit, a great community who answered my questions and provided many more. Thanks to New Stoa for their contributions to Stoicism Online over the years. In addition to the sources, I want to give profound thanks to the many people, authors, and writers who may have told me or exposed me to the stories or bits of wisdom in this book. I transferred much of it to my commonplace book and was so awed by the lessons that I didn't always record attribution. I very much see this book as a collection of the thoughts and actions of people better and smarter than me. I hope you read and hear it in the same way, and attribute any credit deserved accordingly. I must thank the National Arts Club, the Los Angeles Athletic Club, the New York Public Library, the libraries at University of California, Riverside, and a bunch of different Starbucks and airplanes where I wrote or researched this book. The Stoic Reading List. Stoicism is perhaps the only philosophy where the original primary texts are actually cleaner and easier to read than anything the academics have written since. Which is awesome because it means you can dive into the subject and go straight to the source. I firmly believe that everyone is capable of reading these very accessible writers. Coming up are my recommendations both on specific translations and then some additional titles worth looking at. Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, Modern Library. There's only one translation of Marcus Aurelius to read, and that is Gregory Hayes' amazing translation for the Modern Library. Everything else falls sadly short. His version is completely devoid of thous, shalls, shan'ts. It's beautiful and haunting. I've recommended this book to literally thousands of people at this point. Buy it. Change your life. Letters of a Stoic by Seneca. See also On the Shortness of Life. Both these translations by Penguin are fantastic. Seneca or Marcus are the best places to start if you're looking to explore Stoicism. Seneca seems like he would have been a fun guy to know, which is unusual for a Stoic. I suggest starting with On the Shortness of Life, a collection of short essays, and then move to his book on letters, which are really more like essays than true correspondence. Discourses by Epictetus. Personally, I prefer the Penguin translations, but I've tried a handful of others and found the differences to be relatively negligible. Of the big three, Epictetus is probably the most preachy and least fun to read, but he will also from time to time express something so clearly and profoundly that it will shake you to your core. Other books and authors. I know this will seem harsh, but I strongly advise steering clear of most of the other books about Stoicism. I'll make one exception, the works of Pierre Hadot. While all the other academics and popularizers of Stoicism mostly miss the point or needlessly complicate things, Hadot clarifies. His interpretation of Marcus Aurelius in the book The Inner Citadel, that Marcus Aurelius was writing not some systemic explanation of the universe, but creating a set of practical exercises the emperor was actually practicing himself, was a huge leap forward. His book, Philosophy as a Way of Life, explains how philosophy has wrongly been interpreted as a thing people talk about rather than as something that people do. If you really want to dive into practical philosophy, Hadot is the guy to read. Also, his translations of Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and Epictetus, which he does for himself from the originals in his analysis, are quite good. Some other great authors and philosophers to read, particularly their books of maxims or aphorisms, which are in line with a lot of Stoic thinking, are Heraclitus, Arthur Schopenhauer, Plutarch, Socrates, Cicero, and Montaigne. Even if they weren't my publisher, I would recommend starting with Penguin and the Penguin Classics brand when you read these books. Final reading recommendations. I'll end this book with one other recommendation. This book and its stories were a result of the books I've been fortunate enough to come across in my life. Each month, I distill what I read into a short email of book recommendations, which I email out to my network of friends and connections. This list started as about 40 people and is now received and read by 15,000 people from all over the world. All in all, I've recommended, discussed, and chatted about more than 1,000 books with these fellow readers in the last 5 years. If you'd like to join us and get these recommendations, sign up at ryanholiday.net/reading-newsletter, or you can just send me an email at ryanholiday@gmail.com and tell me that you want to get the email. Just put reading list in the subject line. Thank you, and I hope to hear from you soon.